Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2022 Home Education Conference held in Morristown, Tennessee.
So I'm going to talk about cybersecurity, some of the different things about how maybe you can help protect your families, protect yourselves, protect your loved ones. Because even though we're homeschooling and we've got smaller kids, we also have family members that might not be as digitally savvy as we are. And so hopefully some of this will be helpful. So I've worked a lot in the computer security industry building software, but I'm not like a threat analysis or a someone who actually goes after the bad guys. I'm someone who actually writes software that helps them with all the tooling and things that they need to build to help find the bad guys. And actually in October I pivoted and I'm now actually working for a healthcare startup, but again with healthcare you also want to make sure that your data is secure and protected and stuff like that. So I like to kind of talk about what I do is there's a difference between someone who designs and builds cars and someone who's a mechanic and like actually works on cars. And my mom still has a hard time understanding what I do for work, and so she thinks I'm the mechanic person. So she's always asking, hey, can you help me with this? Can you help me with that? Which is fine, because as an engineer, you kind of understand how the system works and stuff like that. But I'm an engineer, a software engineer by trade, not a mechanic kind of thing. So to kind of talk about cybersecurity, I think one of the best ways to think about it is you are not Batman. And what I mean by that is, is Batman, you know, he has all these really expensive things that keeps him safe, keeps his identity secure, so no one knows that it's Batman. And he talks in that really gruff voice, so you can't tell. But you don't have to be Batman. All you have to do is take just a little bit of effort to make yourself a little bit of a harder target, and that will protect you enough from, you know, pretty much everything that's out there. You know, the people that write ransomware, the people that write all the different kind of malware kind of varieties. So hopefully today I'll be able to give you some ideas of what you can do to do that. So in the security industry, they talk about reducing your attack surface. And so there's many ways that you can be attacked or have kind of problems. Everyone nowadays carries around a mobile device. And so there's some things you can do to kind of help yourself with a mobile device and protect yourself. Most of us still have personal computers. For much of the world, you know, they're actually skipping the whole personal computer and going just straight to their mobile phones. But there's still some things you can do on your personal computer. A few things you can do with your home network to kind of protect all the devices in your household, whether it's your kids or people that visit. And then I'll talk a little bit about how you can, you know, protect your social media and your online banking and other kinds of things. So I think that the first thing with your mobile device is you should have a passcode on there. You should have something that, like, when you put your phone down, it should be locked. Because if someone wants to, you know, kind of come up and, like, you know, get on there, they could actually get a lot of information about you. Now, that's, you know, for many people that are at home all the time, maybe not, you know, such a huge deal. But when you're traveling or something like that, make sure you have a passcode on there. And things like Face ID and the fingerprint stuff, that kind of helps, you know, make that a little bit more palatable. You should definitely have that. And make it so it requires a password as soon as you lock it. So like with my device, as soon as I hit the little power button, if I turn it on, like I have to actually like do something in order to log in. I usually use, you know, my fingerprint. And then I think another important thing is to make sure you keep your device updated. So most of the ecosystem, like, you know, on iOS or an Android, it's pretty good about making sure that you know when there's a software update. Make sure you take the time to do those and to update it. And the reason why is because sometimes there's these things called zero-day attacks of where no one has seen it in the wild, and all of a sudden, you know, someone is using an attack to basically get onto people's devices and stuff. And the mobile device vendors, you know, Apple, Google, they're actually pretty good about watching for those things and then making sure that they get a software patch out pretty quickly. So make sure that you kind of keep that up to date. There's actually, it's interesting because when they release those updates, there's this little window of time between when they release it and when the actual malware writers are looking at that release and they're kind of, you know, pulling it apart and figuring out like, hey, what were the interesting things that Google just patched or that Apple just patched? And so you want to make sure you do it quickly because after that window of time has expired, then people are starting to write malware that's targeting those particular attacks. So keep it up to date. Another thing is watch out for rogue apps. So Apple and Google and some of the other marketplaces are pretty good at like finding malware that makes it into their app store and getting rid of it. But every so often there are things that kind of make it through. And so you want to be kind of careful about what you download. I know for myself, I don't download a whole lot of stuff. But the things that I do download, I make sure that they're from trusted sources and that they're downloading your banking app is probably fine, but downloading other things, you want to be careful. And that doubly goes for like side loading. So sometimes you can actually kind of defeat the mechanisms on your phone to install software that maybe you can't get in the App Store. And you want to just completely stay away from that kind of stuff because that stuff has a much higher potential of having like malware in it and stuff like that. Now you probably don't think that's interesting for yourselves because you're probably never going to do that. But your kids might do that because kids like to kind of push the edges to things. They like to figure out where hey, their friend told them about this really cool thing. You can't get in the App Store, but if you do these steps, you can get onto your phone and stuff like that. And so maybe that warrants having a conversation with your kids and being like, hey, so don't install stuff just because the kid down the street said to do that. So the question is are there certain sites that you can go to get recommended software? I think you mentioned CNET. I don't trust CNET because oftentimes a lot of those aggregators, they will add additional things into there, whether it's browser toolbar helpers and other things. And it ends up being a lot of spyware and stuff. Typically, if you can, go to the source, because CNET will also package it up with other things that, where they'll pull in like open source products, and they'll kind of like, hey, it's CNET, you can download it from here. We've scanned it, we've done all these kind of things. I don't trust CNET personally, so I usually go other places. It kind of depends on the software. My wife can tell you that like I don't install actually very much software on the computer because I know that like as much like everything you install kind of increases your attack surface in the sense of like how much. You're kind of trusting someone else on your machine, kind of thing. But all right, switching to personal computers. So just like with your mobile device, there are updates that come out with your personal computer, and you should make sure that your computer is set to auto update to get those updates and apply them even without your intervention and stuff. Because that is again just like with your mobile device. There's attacks that come out, and the vendors like Microsoft and Apple, they end up kind of finding those, fixing those, and they have actually, with Microsoft, it's called Patch Tuesday, where every month there's patches that come out, and oftentimes those have like security patches. Every once in a while, they'll have something that's so serious that they're like, "Hey, we got to patch it right away." Make sure that your personal computer is up to date, and that also has to do with your browsers because they have kind of a separate update life cycle. How many of you guys use Chrome? So if you look in Chrome, up at the very top where you can sign in. There's oftentimes your profile picture, and sometimes there's a little update, and it will actually start out as green, and then it kind of gets red, and like different shades to kind of show, hey, you really need to do this. And so that one is kind of a little bit separate. I think you might be able to set Chrome to update, but usually what it means you have to restart Chrome, and you see, you hit that button, and it will automatically shut down Chrome and restart it with the latest patch and stuff like that. But you should do that for sure. All right. Now, most malware that people get on their machine, on their personal computer, is either accidentally or intentionally installed. And intentionally doesn't mean that they were looking for malware, but it's they downloaded something that had some extra in it and installed it. And so just like with your phone, you want to be really cautious and really careful about the kind of things you install on your computer because it's just like inviting a friend into your house. If you invite everyone into your house and you invite shady characters in your house, they're going to do shady things. I actually, years ago, I don't know if you remember, there was kind of this meme about dancing hamsters. And sometimes, there would be software that's like, hey, you just got to install this, and you can see dancing hamsters. It's really cute, and they're really fun. And you install those, and I kind of use that as a metaphor for, like, malware. Sometimes there's, like, this little thing that, like, I really want that. I install it, and you get other things on there that you don't want on there. So that is what I would suggest doing, is just be really careful about what you install on there. Along with that is there's this thing called ransomware. You've probably heard about in the news. I think it was last year, the Colonial Pipeline got shut down, and it ended up, you know, causing everyone's fuel costs to go up because they got ransomware on their computers and stuff. And that can actually also happen to even you, because there's basically it's software that ends up encrypting or locking up all the files on your computer. In order to get them back, usually they have, like, you've got to pay a ransom. You've got to pay some, you know, some non-traceable bitcoins or something like that in order to unlock it. Again, that is usually because people are installing things accidentally or intentionally that end up having that ransomware piece in there. But the best way to protect yourself against ransomware is to back up your computer, to back up your photos, to back up the things that you care. And that can be as simple as, like, buying an external hard drive. A lot of the Mac OS and Windows, they already have backup solutions kind of built in where you can just back up your drive to that external drive. But that's probably, in my mind, the best way to protect against ransomware, other than not downloading and installing software that you don't trust. So the question is how long do external drives last? And there's kind of two answers, you know, there's kind of two parts to answer. First of all, if you get one that's too small, you might end up filling it up too quickly, right? And so that could be, like, you know, a part of that lifetime. But then as far as the failure time, they have what's called a mean time to failure, of where oftentimes hardware will fail in the first few months. And if it doesn't fail at that point, then it kind of takes a little bit longer for it to fail, because typically if it survives that initial burn-in period, it's going to last for quite a while. I actually use my tech until it's practically dead, kind of thing. But I also have multiple backup drives that I'll kind of swap in and out, so that way if I have one that fails, then I still have a backup that's okay. I think that typically you could probably get, like, 3 to 4 to 5 years out of a backup drive. Again, if you got a big enough one that, you know, you weren't going to fill up pretty quickly. I have so much backup material at home. Like, I still have, like, DVDs and CDs that have, like, content burned on from 20 years ago that I probably can't even read now because it's, you know, hard to find a reader for those. And then the last question that sometimes people ask about your personal computer is about antivirus. Now, a lot of the vendors, like, for example, Microsoft, there's Windows Defender that's actually, you know, comes, you know, packaged with Windows. And in my mind, that's actually good enough. You don't have to go install, you know, McAfee or Norton or something like that. And again, my, you know, because, well, that's what I don't do that. I just use Windows Defender, and it's actually pretty good for catching whatever makes it through my not install anything policy. There is there's a gentleman named Brian Krebs that used to write for the Washington Post, and he has this website that he really tracks a lot of the different threats that are out there, and he has, you know, fascinating articles, at least if you're in the industry. But he had these three basic rules for online security as far as your computer is concerned. He says, don't install it if you weren't looking for it. So sometimes, you know, a lot of the malware tries to get you to install it. You know, they have, like, oh yeah, you know, you've got infected. Install this, and we'll help you, you know, kind of clean it up. But, you know, if you're looking for it, that's a little different. If you're like, hey, I need this package of software to do whatever I'm trying to do, then, you know, then it's a little bit better. If you install it, update it. Make sure it stays up to date. You know, if you've got Chrome, make sure it stays up to date, or whatever you're using. And then his third rule is, if you no longer need it, uninstall it. Because even if you install something today, and, you know, there's actually plenty of examples in the software industry of software that was safe today, but then, like, if you roll forward 5 years, there's, like, attacks that happen against it, or malware creeps into it, or, you know, and so it kind of gets out of date. So if you aren't using it, just uninstall. And that actually goes for your phone as well. If you've got apps on there that you're not using, you haven't used for a while, and some of the app, you know, like, for example, on my phone, it'll be like, hey, you haven't used this app in, like, 6 months. Do you want to go ahead and uninstall it? Or it'll start removing permissions as it goes along that I haven't used it for a while. So, all right. Okay, so now I want to talk about browser safety. So browsers are a whole other set of vulnerabilities and threats. One of the biggest is extensions. So you've probably installed, like, a couple extensions. Actually, sometimes Chrome even comes with a few extensions from, like, Google to be able to help you with Google Drive and, like, the Google Docs experience. Again, just, you know, whenever you install an extension, you're, again, inviting someone into your house. You're inviting someone in to be able to, like, read the traffic that you when you communicate with the website or do other kind of things. So you want to be very judicious and very cautious about the kind of extensions you install. And I'll actually talk about a couple of extensions that I use that I would recommend using and stuff. So the second point is don't allow, well, I don't allow very many sites to do notifications on my computer. So sometimes you'll go to a place and they'll be like, hey, you know, let us use your location or let us use notifications and stuff. And that's where we kind of get to the issue that you were bringing up. And I have a picture actually in the slides of an example of a virus detected. And you look at it, and you know, to the casual observer, you look at it and you're like, oh wow, it's a virus, and it's like a system alert, and it's not actually in the context of the browser. It's something there on your desktop that's saying, you know, that it found. But if you look at the image, you can actually see a couple hints about that it's actually not what it says it is. If you look at the very top of the notification, it says Google Chrome. Okay, so it's basically Windows allowing Chrome to do a system notification, and Chrome is saying this website has a notification, and I'm going to show it via the Windows notification system. So it looks like it's Windows, but it's not. It's coming from Chrome. And if you look down into the actual alerts, you'll see that it has actually the website there, because Chrome is like, hey, we don't, you know, they're going to attribute who is doing that notification to the website that's actually popping the notification. So you can see it's CAPTCHA. CAPTCHATopSource.com, okay, that's doing that notification. It has nothing to do with Windows. It's not, you know, a system alert. It's this website that very well might actually be a legitimate website, but someone has hacked that website and using the notification system to try to get you to install something, right? So, I don't know. It's and the thing about computer security is what I'm telling you today will change in like 3 years easily. Probably, you know, some of it might already be out of date, but well, it's probably not out of date right now. All right, so I don't let websites do notifications with few exceptions. Like I might let Google, Gmail do notifications because then I get that little pop-up saying, hey, you've got mail or something like that. Any random website asking you to do notifications, you're going to basically be allowing them to do that that little trick there. Another thing that I use for security is actually an ad blocker. Because some of these malware and other kinds of things get transmitted through the ad networks and stuff. The ad networks are getting better at this in the sense of like trying to like, you know, prevent malware writers or people trying to get you to do those, you know, trick you into clicking it. But I use an ad blocker. Now, not all ad blockers are equal, because there's actually some ad blockers that are out there that like also do some shady stuff. I use one called uBlock Origin. It's been around for a while. If you go to like the Chrome store, you can see it has that, you know, 10 million downloads and stuff like that. And the caveats are not all browsers support extensions like that and stuff, but it's actually something that I do whenever I so like for example, my mom, she'll come and she'll be like, hey, can you help me with that computer? And I'm like, holy cow, you've got ads all over it. Let me install an ad blocker really quickly, and it makes a much better web experience for them. But anyway, and they can also increase your privacy as well. You probably heard about privacy in the news and tracking and how all these websites, you know, they're basically tracking wherever you go because they want to be able to target ads to you and target, like, you know, things. Ad blockers help for that because they actually know, like, hey, this is a major, you know, vendor of tracking software. We're going to just block, you know, the actual connection to that site and stuff. All right, so I want to talk about passwords. So the first tip is don't reuse passwords, okay? Now, I know I've done it in the past, long ago, but the risk with reusing a password, and sometimes people are like, well, how do I keep track of those passwords? And I'll kind of get to, like, you know, a help on that one. But the problem with reusing a password is it's a secret that you've given to someone. If you reuse it, you're giving it to all these other people. And you may trust each one of those individually, but there may be one of them that they don't have their security practices right, you know, on that website, and it ends up getting hacked, and then the passwords get leaked, and now your password, all of those sites are hacked. And that's actually how some of the big hacks happen. So when they say, like, oh, LinkedIn, it has this many million passwords, well, it's actually not that site, but it's another site that those passwords are reused. And then they were used on LinkedIn to try to, like, you know, log into people's accounts and stuff. And, oh, look, now that LinkedIn is hacked. Well, so if you reuse your passwords, that's what you're inviting. Now, some people come up with, you know, clever ways of, like, oh, well, I'll have one password, and then I'll just morph it, you know, for each site and stuff. But my suggestion is actually use what's called a password manager. The password manager I use, you know, there's several that are out there, but I use 1Password, and this is where the funny story comes in. So 1Password actually has this family account where you can, you know, for like $5 a month, you can get 5 accounts. And so, like, it was a couple years ago that I had my family using this free open source thing that was kind of a pain to use, and my work actually paid for 1Password at work, and that gave everyone a license at home. So I set all my kids up, I set my daughters up, and when they're at school, it makes it really easy for me to share a password with them, you know, using 1Password. And anyway, so my daughter had this account that she didn't want to put in 1Password because it was kind of a pain, and so she wrote it down, and she was working with a fellow student. And she felt bad that she had done this, like writing it down and stuff. And so she was explaining, well, you know, I usually use 1Password. And he says, yeah, I use 1Password as well. And he wasn't meaning the software 1Password. He was meaning 1Password everywhere, which was, you know, it gave my daughter quite a chuckle because, you know, anyway, it was just really funny. So don't reuse your passwords. It's not horrible to write it down in, like, you know, like a notebook or something like that. I find it a little bit inconvenient, but using something like a password manager, it actually will help you create a hard, complicated password. You don't have to remember it because it will actually, they have browser extensions for them that can, like, automatically put your username and password into the site. Anyway, that's what I use, is a password manager. There's other ones that are out there. You've probably heard of LastPass, maybe. There's Password Safe. I have a couple links in the presentation that if you're interested in looking at more. So the other thing is you don't want to reuse passwords, but you also want to choose a complicated password. Now you don't have to be super, super complicated. Like a phrase, a long enough phrase would actually work. And that's where actually I included kind of an image of this web comic that talks about it. So a long password, 12, 14 characters or more, that is definitely way, way better than like a short password of like 6 or 8 characters. And the reason why is because machines, as they get faster and faster, they can guess passwords. And if you can do like an offline attack, like some of those, like just adding another character of complexity can add, you know, months and years on to like the guessability of that from a computer perspective. I actually included a little comic. This is a pretty famous web comic from a gentleman called, you know, the web comic is XKCD. But he kind of, you know, shows that, like, hey, choosing all these weird symbols and characters that, like, you can get the same amount of security by just being much longer. And so he actually says, you know, the password, let's see, what was the password? Correct horse battery stable. So those 4 unrelated words, how many characters is it? I forget how many characters it is, but it's really long, and it's better than this, like, 8 or 10 character with, like, you know, uppercase T and a lowercase R and a 0 and a percent sign. Now, you don't want to use that password, correct horse battery staple, as your password, because that's now a well-known password kind of thing. But just the longer, the better. But again, if you're using a password manager, you don't have to worry about that as much, because you can actually tell it, like, how complicated you want it, you know, how many characters. And then because it's storing it, you don't have to remember it. So there's many passwords I don't even know, you know, I couldn't tell you what the password is because my password manager is kind of storing it for me. So let's talk about the next thing, two-step authentication or verification. So this is, if you don't have two-step turned on, you should turn it on. And a lot of the popular services like Gmail already have it. You know, they'll actually, you know, ask you, hey, do you want to turn this on? So how it works is basically your password is pretty good, but they know that people reuse passwords and people use, you know, weak passwords. And so what a two-factor authentication is another source it's basically a little code that is randomly or kind of randomly generated that is a second password you put in. And how this is usually manifest is you'll have a little 6-digit number that changes every 30 seconds or 60 seconds. That the website will say, okay, you put your password in. Now we want you to put in this 6-digit code. Other sites will actually SMS it to you. You know, you'll get a text message. They'll say, hey, you know, for example, banks oftentimes do this where they're like, okay, you're on a new device. we're going to send you the 6-digit code either, you know, via text or email. You need to go look at your text. You need to go look at your email. Take that 6-digit code, you know, copy and paste it in here, and then we'll let you in. And actually, a lot of sites enable this. So if you have an Amazon account, you can set up two-factor authentication. So that way, only you can get in. Even if, you know, even if your kid knows your password, you have to have that second step to get in. This, but you know, like, so as a security, you know, we're working for a security company. This is what one of the biggest recommendations the security company would make to every business that we work with was turn on two-factor authentication. And the reason is because if someone's password is guessed or hacked, and you know, you get this attempted login from a remote country, you know, they don't have that two-factor, you know, that 6-digit number. And so, you know, it is able to prevent so many hacks. Now, it's surprising how many businesses actually, for whatever reason, feel like they can't turn it on. But it was like the number one recommendation that was always made. I included some pictures in there of some of the popular authentication apps. So there's one by Twilio, Microsoft has one, there's a Google Authenticator, I think Duo also you can save those passwords in. But if you don't have two-factor turned on your Gmail account, that's like the very first thing you should probably do is like turn it on, enable it. Now, Google is actually pretty good because, you know, so the biggest reason why people don't turn this on is because it's a little bit inconvenient. But a lot of these sites, they're actually getting pretty good at like, okay, you log down from that device. Do you want to trust that device in the future? Google, you set up a trusted device. So when you log in for the first time on a computer, they're like, hey, we're going to send you a little notification to your phone, and then you can accept or deny that there to say, hey, yeah, I trust this connection. Now, all this said about two-factor off and turn it on, a lot of times people just hit that accept button constantly, okay? So you should hit that accept button when you're expecting it. So that means when you're logging into the site and you know it's coming, if you're ever if you're ever talking on the phone to someone and, you know, it's a malicious person and they're like, hey, so I'm going to send you this, give me the 6-digit code over the phone, like, your bank is not going to do that. So make sure you guard your two-factor off in the same way that you would guard a password. Only put it in when you expect to put it in. All right. So now the next one, it's going to start kind of touching on the parental controls. So when you're most everyone has an internet router that that all your devices talk to in order to talk to the internet, and that router might be through very few people actually plug anything into that device anymore. Most of the time it's over Wi-Fi, you know, over the wireless. Now, most of the time with your internet provider, your cable provider, fiber, whatever you have, they'll automatically have all the information, you know, in the router to be able to talk to the, you know, to be able to find websites on the internet and stuff. But you can actually go in and customize that. There's a service called OpenDNS that they have a couple free variations. One is the Family Shield and one is the home version. That basically what you're doing is you are in your router, you're saying, hey, instead of going to these addresses to find, you know, things on the internet, use these other addresses. And that seems like the worst way of describing this. but it's something called DNS, and it's basically how your computer translates when you type in Amazon.com into actually where the computer is to go and talk to. So OpenDNS, I think they were bought by Cisco a few years ago, but it will give you some very basic protections against adult content, against malware sites. Basically, they have a whole list of like, hey, these sites are bad, and you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't go there because you'll get malware, or maybe you don't want your kids going there. And the nice thing about doing this from your router is you don't have to go to each of your devices and your kids' devices, because it's done actually at the router layer. And so every device that's in your home network would be protected by turning this on. Now, I kind of included a little screenshot of my setup on my router, and this may be like super scary to you to be like, oh no, I don't want to go log into my router, and you might not even have the ability to do that. A lot of routers will actually have on the back, they'll have like the password you would use to log into there. But if you go to the OpenDNS website, they'll actually kind of give you some basic steps of how you would end up doing this. That's probably, I don't know, maybe too complicated for a lot of people, but it's one way to just really quickly protect your whole network. And I'll actually get to more on the parental stuff in a minute, but that's kind of the beginning of the parental stuff, okay? And that actually for your child, if he, you can get around these things. And actually how your child would probably get around it is they would either on their own device, they would set their own DNS addresses where they would be like, I don't want to use the one that the router gave me. I want to use these other ones. And that's how they would kind of get around it. But so this is one of those kind of things that's like you could do it, but a compliant, a compliant child would, benefit from it. But a non-compliant child is going to find a way around it. But it's also great for yourself, too, because, like, there's malware that you might accidentally click a link, and then it's like, it was blocked by OpenDNS, because OpenDNS is like, yep, that's a known bad site, and they'll actually...
If they're on Wi-Fi, yeah, if they're not on Wi-Fi, then...
Yeah, if they're outside of your home, then, like, they aren't going to your router, and so
they,
yeah.
Just click off not to be on your Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Yeah, if they're doing the... If they're using the phone network to do it, for sure, yeah. So this is, for your Wi-Fi. All right, let's see. I want to talk a little bit about social media. So this is probably something that you already understand, but, like, don't post pictures of credit cards or driver's license or things like that. And again, just like with Amazon and Gmail, you can get two-factor auth to turn on for your social media stuff. So that way it prevents someone from logging into your social media. Set your privacy to friends only, unless you want to be sharing everything with the public. Don't post when you're going on vacation and other kinds of things. Or use your precise location, because those are kind of things that, like, oftentimes, people run into to trouble with. Don't post pictures with your home address on there. These are probably, like, mostly common sense kind of things that you would do. And again, social media, there's links that people, get sent, and you don't click on those links unless you really trust the sender or the link. So just be careful with that. I don't have a ton to say about social media because I'm actually not on social media, really. But I know that doesn't work for everyone. So, all right. I want to talk a little bit about just some financial security as far as, like, with ATMs and banking. So the first one I want to talk about is ATMs. So have you guys ever heard of a card skimmer? You guys ever seen something on the news? So these are little teeny devices that the baddies, they put inside of the actual card reader, and you slip your card in there, and it doesn't even, you can't even tell. You pull it out, and it's basically swiped all the information off the magnetic strip. So I think that the biggest thing here is don't use shady ATMs. I won't call out particular vendors, but if you use an ATM for a bank, it's in their best interest to make sure you don't have, like, an attack. When you use your PIN number, so these skimmers aren't always enough for the baddies. They also need your PIN number often. So if you're using a debit card at, like, the convenience store and you swipe it and you have to put your PIN number in, cover it up. Because what will usually happen is they pair these skimmers with a little teeny pinhole camera that's kind of watching the keypad. And so when you type it in so everyone can see it, then the camera sees it and records it, and then they can correlate the two together and withdraw money from your account. And that's actually really hard when they're using your PIN number to, like, go to the bank and be like, it wasn't me. And they're like, well, we gave you a PIN number, and the PIN number was used to do that. So don't use shady ATMs and cover your, cover your hand when you're putting your PIN number in. And I think the other thing is just to watch for suspicious things. You can actually go onto YouTube and you can find videos of these people installing these skimmers on top of the point of sale thing. Like, it's really fascinating. Like, there's one that these three guys walk in and they, two of them distract the clerks and the other guy just out of his bag flips it on and he's done. I mean, it's installed skimming cards at that point. So just be careful with that. And then just watch your bank statements, like, make sure that you're doing kind of the good financial hygiene to make sure you're aware of whatever that is. Along with that, the bank is never going to call you and then walk you through how to install software on your machine so they can remotely help you on your machine. They never do that. Anyone that's asking you to do that is very clearly a baddie. Now, I don't think any of us would fall prey to that, but we might have other people in our personal networks that are more trusting and stuff. I have a friend that that's what happened to his mother, that there was actually, a former workplace. It actually wasn't the former workplace, but claimed to be the former workplace, and how that they had accidentally sent her too much money, and they needed to, they needed to give her money back, and it was really complicated, and we'll help you out by, install the software, walk her through how to, like, do that, and then they basically had her put all the numbers in, and then oops, you know, there's like a different number, and she hits okay, and they're like, oh no, you just debited money from our account, now you have to give it back, and basically cleared her out of all of her savings and stuff. Now, the thing that made this worse, and this is my next slide, is about shame. She felt really bad about this because she realized what she had done, and she didn't want to tell anyone about it because she felt really embarrassed. Now, mistakes happen. In my household, things have been installed on my computer. I mean, it's not hard because these things, they're really trying to trick you into it, right? So the thing is, if you make a mistake, talk to someone that you trust. Talk to someone and let them know as soon as possible. Because if this woman had talked to her son, you know, like she let it go about 4, 5, 6 days, and then by that time the money's out of her account, it's gone. The bank really can't do anything to get it back. I mean, she can try getting a lawyer to try to get it back, but like it's an uphill battle at that point. So, when you make mistakes, or when some of your personal networks make mistakes, like it's okay to like make mistakes. It's you know, but don't compound that with the second mistake of like not telling anyone. So. All right, so now it's all the rage today is the phishing and smishing. Has anyone got a text on their phone that like looked dodgy or suspicious? I think everyone at this point has, right? And these are really tricky because they have a story that goes behind them. They have this hook, you know. It's, for example, actually I included a screenshot of one that my daughter sent me. She's like, does this look suspicious? I'm like, yeah, it looks suspicious. First of all, it's a bank she doesn't even know asking her to verify some online activity, you know? So the story is like, oh no, maybe someone's used my account incorrectly. The bank is just asking me, they're trying to help me out. Like, I'll click on that link and, you know, I'll resolve it. And then you go to this website and they're using all of the marketing collateral. You know, they've got the logo and they've got all this official stuff and maybe a few misspelled words here and there. I mean, that's often a dead giveaway too. And then they have that story, but they also demand urgency. You need to take care of it right now, because if you don't, like, bad things could happen, okay? So I have kind of some tips about what you can do about phishing. So the first thing is, take 5 minutes, take a breather, like, don't act on it immediately. That's actually, at my work, they would send phishing emails intentionally trying to get, you know, to teach the employees and stuff, don't click the link. I worked at a security company, and it was amazing how many people would click on the link still. And the biggest thing was, like, take 5 minutes, just step away, ask someone else. You know, some of the favorites were they would, hey, there's a survey, you know, for a company party coming up in a couple weeks. Click on the link, you know. And so what would usually happen is people were like, hey, did everyone else get that email? You know, it's like, oh, yeah, that's definitely a fish kind of thing. So take 5 minutes, take a break. Don't click on the link. Sometimes the links are taking you to a website that's like tricking you or trying to get you to that. Sometimes they're taking you to a place to like download an attachment, install something. Just don't click the link. All right, so I have a bunch here about phone scams. Again, that's probably more for like our extended network. But there's some tips on there. I kind of wanted to just jump down to the parental controls because I know that's a kind of a big thing. So I put a quote in here that I'm sure you've heard before, and it's the popular quote that's attributed to Joseph Smith, where he said, I teach them correct principles and they govern themselves. And the reason why I put that in here is because many of the things that you can do, the parental controls, a dedicated child, maybe a really motivated child can get around those kind of things. And even if they can't, they can usually find a device that can get them access to that kind of things. So I think that the biggest thing for protecting your children is to make sure you're teaching those principles to them, okay? Now, that's not always satisfactory because you're like, but what can I do? I actually have a link here to an August 2001 Ensign that has a bunch of suggestions about what parents can do as far as devices in their home and stuff. Now, this was written in 2001. This was before, like, kids had these little devices. You know, every kid seems to have one. But some of the advice was like put computers in public, but open access areas, you know, don't let them have it in their bedroom. But I think a lot of these things, you know, check the browser history for your kids periodically. I think a lot of these could also apply to mobile devices though. And a lot of times, what I do for my family works for my family, but it might not work for your family. So, like, it's kind of one of those things that you have to kind of come up with your own kind of way to work that. You know, and as you're, exactly, but as your kids get older, like, they will get more, you know, you have to, like, let them learn at some point. I think for me, like, when I try to have a really heartfelt conversation with a child and be like, I'm doing these things to try to help you. I know you can circumvent them. I have circumvented them before. Like, please don't, you know. Which actually is another story of mine from a coworker at a previous place I worked that he also, like, the IT people were like, stop it, please. And he's like, he could get around everything they were doing. Just in closing, so, like, if you take anything away today, set up your two-factor auth with Gmail, install an ad blocker if you haven't already, and then set up OpenDNS as a family filter kind of thing. And then extra credit would be setting up a password manager and starting to use one of those to store your passwords instead of other things.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.